Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
I've said it many times, and it's no more true or real than we think about the events of January 6th. We are in a battle for the soul of America, a battle that by the grace of God and the goodness and gracious and greatness of this nation, we will win.
That is Joe Biden, the President of the United States, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. Glad to be with you, and I'll always be glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to talk about that speech that Joe Biden gave just a few hours ago and what he said in it and where he lied in it. And I'm going to call him out on these specific lies because I'm virtually certain that the mainstream media is not going to call out Joe Biden for the Pinocchios that he so richly deserves for what he had to say about what happened 1 year ago today on January the 6th on Capitol Hill. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to be with you. 22 years of serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We'll be glad to get your phone calls and your emails. But I want to say a few things about Joe Biden's January 6th lies. The lies of the president never seem to stop. And today, they hit a crescendo on the anniversary of the riot at the Capitol on January 6th. And I'm not going to call it anything but. They are not terrorists, as Ted Cruz tried to say yesterday. They are also not an insurrection, as the Chicken Noodle News Network and others continue to insist. And basically, I've taken the FBI's conclusion. They investigated last year and said, we found no sign that there was coordination of groups or an attempt to overthrow the government of the United States. And if you haven't looked up the word insurrection or sedition recently, you have to understand that's what an insurrection is, an attempt to take over the government. Well, let me focus on just two of the lies that Joe Biden told today in that speech. He accused the rioters of killing Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick. Now, that one I can call out as a flat lie. The Washington, D.C. medical examiner looked at Brian Sicknick's body, did an autopsy, determined what killed him. What killed him was a stroke. A stroke 1 day after the Capitol incident. You might say to yourself, yes, but Lars, didn't the injuries that he suffered on January the 6th cause that stroke? And the answer is also given by the Washington, D.C. medical examiner. He says, no, the officer had no injuries from the January 6th riot that would explain why he had a stroke. People have strokes in America. This one was natural causes. It was not the result of being killed by people during that Capitol riot. And yet, listen to what Joe Biden says about police officers who have died.
Some have already made the ultimate sacrifice in this sacred effort. Jill and I have mourned police officers in this Capitol Rotunda, not once, but twice in the wake of January 6th. Once to honor Officer Brian Sicknick, who lost his life the day after the attack. And a second time to honor Officer Billy Evans, who lost his life defending this Capitol as well.
Now, think about that for just one moment. I want to call him out on the specific lies that he told today. Joe Biden, President of the United States, makes an accusation of murder against Americans, despite the clear evidence that, at least in the case of Officer Sicknick, no such murder happened. And then Joe Biden constructively lied again. Here's what he did. He referred to a second police officer. And I know that for a lot of us who covered what happened last year, a year ago today, we said, hold on. There was one police officer whose death was incorrectly attributed to the events of January 6th. Where did this second officer come from? Well, Joe Biden gave us his name, Officer Billy Evans. Do you know when Officer Billy Evans died? He died on April the 2nd of last year. And if you say, well, Lars, did it take that long for him to die after the January 6th riot? No. His death was not in connection with the January 6th riot. He was killed when Noah Green, a follower of the Nation of Islam's Louis Farrakhan, rammed a barricade with his car at the Capitol on the 2nd of April of last year. And if you say, well, maybe he's just another one of those Trump nuts. No, he wasn't. Noah Green turned out to be a follower of the Nation of Islam. He apparently hated the cops. He suspected the CIA. He had a lot of beefs with the government. But his death had absolutely nothing to do with January the 6th. Now, is it constructively lying when the President of the United States says in the wake of January 6th, We mourn two police officers. Well, yes, I would call that out as a lie. And will the major media call out Joe on that fabrication, making Americans believe the two officers who did not die because of January 6th were somehow connected and their deaths connected to January 6th? I would call that a lie. And what about Ashley Babbitt? Ashley Babbitt never got mentioned today by Joe Biden, the only person who was actually murdered on January 6th. Ashley Babbitt was shot to death by a Capitol cop. And what did the Biden administration determine? They determined that that cop will face no charges for deliberately shooting a young woman who did not pose an imminent threat. So Biden also claims, and here's the second lie, that anyone who is concerned about the laws that were broken in the November 3rd election is lying. And he accused tens of millions of Americans of lying. Take a listen.
This isn't about being bogged down in the past. This is about making sure the past isn't buried. That's the only way forward. That's what great nations do. They don't bury the truth. They face up to it.
Now, Joe Biden, in saying don't bury the truth, is talking about January the 6th. He's not talking about November 3rd, 2020, the election in which laws were broken to affect the election of Joe Biden. And we've pointed out all the laws that were broken, and there's even more evidence available today than there was a year ago. Biden referred to President Trump 12 times today, but Joe Biden, the president, never had the guts to actually say Donald Trump's names. Who is he? Voldemort or something? And then you've got the vice president of the United States, and listen to the comparison she makes to Pearl Harbor.
Certain dates echo throughout history, including dates that instantly remind all who have lived through them where they were and what they were doing when our democracy came under assault. Dates that occupy not only a place on our calendars, but a place in our collective memory. December 7th, 1941, September 11th, 2001, and January 6th, 2021.
Consider what she just did. The Vice President of the United States, the affirmative action hire Kamala Harris, is comparing an attack by the nation of Japan on the United States in 1941, an attack by foreign nationals on the United States on September 11th, with a violent protest that took part on the 6th of January of last year. To put those three together is absolutely out of line. And accusing tens of millions of Americans concerned about the election of being liars while Joe Biden is saying we don't want to bury the truth. He certainly does want to bury the truth. But the thing is, the Democrats don't have anything to offer. Energy prices are soaring and supply is shrinking. A humiliating and deadly Afghanistan retreat. China Joe's shut down the virus promise revoked. What else can they run for election on this fall? How else can they justify their proposed federal takeover of state elections? Coming up in just a moment on the Northwest Nonsense, we'll talk about the timeline and the test kits and COVID and Omicron. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, once you get Joe Biden started lying, he just doesn't want to quit. Joe Biden has a timeline problem, and let me describe what it is. It doesn't have to do with January 6th, even though today is the anniversary of the Capitol riots. No, this has to do with COVID and Omicron and rapid testing. I want to remind you of a little bit of history. During the 2020 campaign, Joe Biden made a promise that the first thing he would do in office, this was during the presidential campaign, he was going to come into office on January 20th, and the very first thing he would do is get every American, quote, access to regular, reliable, and free testing. Take a listen to that promise.
We need to scale up testing so anyone who needs one can get a test. After 10 months of the pandemic, we still don't have enough testing. It's a travesty.
It's a travesty, he says. Now, that's easy to say when you're a candidate for president, and then you make the promise, the first thing I'm going to do is make sure everybody has easy access to testing. So that's what Joe Biden did in January of last year, right? No, turns out he didn't. So 11 months into his presidency, not the first thing he was going to do, Biden said that promises, the tests would be available during the holidays. Take a listen to that promise in November.
We're going to make available free tests at thousands of convenient locations for folks to pick them up and take a test kit home. The bottom line, this winter, you'll be able to test for free in the comfort of your home and have some peace of mind.
Now, that was the promise from November, but like with most Joe Biden's promises, like I'm not going to leave everybody behind, a bunch of Americans behind in Afghanistan, you know what to expect when Joe Biden makes a promise. During the holidays, Biden then said rapid tests, well, they're not going to be coming out in December. They're going to come out at the beginning of January. This is the promise that Joe Biden made in the month of December.
Rapid tests will start going out in the beginning of January because they're being produced now.
Yeah, they're being produced now, he claims. Now, consider this. He's promising in the fall of 2020 that the first thing he's going to do is make rapid tests available. 11 months in November, he says they're going to come out in December. Then in December, he says they're going to come out in January. So what's the status today? Biden's testing website is not even up. The contract to order more tests is not even finalized, and the date for when the tests will be available keeps getting pushed back. Meanwhile, Americans keep waiting for more tests. It's another promise made and another promise broken in Joe Biden's failure to, quote, shut down the virus. In fact, I'll point out to you, during the holidays between Christmas and New Year's, a good time for a politician to say something and almost nobody's going to notice except people like me. Joe Biden said, yeah, it turns out there's no federal role in shutting the virus down. I'm handing the problem back to the states, kind of like he handed off the border problem to Kamala Harris. With the Omicron cases spreading like wildfire, the White House is finally saying, okay, we're going to make free antigen tests available to all. But it turns out that way back last October, Joe Biden's White House was approached by private sector entities that said, listen, we can get rapid testing available ahead of the holidays. Except he said no to that and then made the promise in November and the promise in December. And now he's making more promises this month. It's absolutely disgusting. In any case, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And for all the naysayer emails that I get, people saying, well, you're wrong about that, go ahead and call the show, 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, I'll put you right to the head of the line. The promise is you get a chance to make your case, and then you have to take a couple of questions from me. And if you want to ask questions of me, I'm happy to do that as well. What do I get? I'm going to leave the name off of this at the request of the sender. Lars, it's happening. Nike is now firing people for not getting the jab. Not me. We have a group of Nike employees on Signal who are collaborating and supporting one another in our decision not to get the shot. The employee that got noticed today has been at Nike for 31 years. It'll probably be me at some point. Now, I've told the people who email me like that, I said, you want to come on the show? I'll leave your name off. We'll make sure that you're protected as well as we can protect you. But I would ask you to consider this. The OSHA mandate was shot down by the federal courts. That was one of Joe Biden's. The health care mandate, in which Joe Biden ordered that all health care people at institutions that take money from the federal government, which is virtually all of them between Medicare and Medicaid and state government funding, almost everybody who works in health care is at an institution where they get government money. Some of those institutions, Rhode Island hospitals, are hiring people back who are unvaccinated. Why? Because they realized we can't do the job without it. In fact, our Twitter poll today is a good example of this, where the federal government comes down with a mandate for the people and says, all of you have to mandate. Well, guess what? The U.S. Postal Service says that Joe Biden's vaccine mandate, they cannot comply with it. That if they had to comply, if they have to fire the unvaccinated, the U.S. Postal Service would completely shut down. So the U.S. Postal Service, which was facing a November 22 deadline and now is facing a deadline in this year, is now asking for more time. They sent out a letter yesterday to OSHA saying, requiring workers to be vaccinated against the coronavirus or presenting weekly negative tests would hurt the agency's ability to deliver the mail and strain the nation's supply chains even further. A vaccine or test mandate, according to the Deputy Postmaster General Douglas Tulino, quote, is likely to result in the loss of many employees, either by employees leaving or by employees being disciplined. So when the federal government comes down with a mandate and then says, and then the federal agencies themselves, because the Postal Service, while it's an independent agency, is still a U.S. federal government agency. When they say, we can't even get it done, what are you doing to the private sector? The Mayo Clinic announced this week they are firing 700 healthcare professionals. Now, imagine what that's going to do. And when your local hospitals start to say, even here in the Northwest, we don't have the staff, we're being overrun. They're not being overrun by COVID. Omicron is sending far fewer people to the hospital. What's happened is the hospital systems have fired so many doctors, so many nurses, so many staff members. That is what is overwhelming the hospital system. The systems, I have no sympathy for at all. I do have sympathy for the medical professionals who are being given the bum's rush, like 700 people fired at the Mayo Clinic. It makes absolutely no sense. But vote in our Twitter poll. If even federal agencies can't comply with the unconstitutional vax mandate, why should private sector companies do it at all? And I'd ask that of Nike. Why are you firing people who've been with you for 31 years, like the one I just mentioned? Why are you firing those people for not getting the jab? The very people who are imposing the mandate from the federal government side are saying we can't even comply with it. So why should the private sector do it? It's like rules for thee, but not for me. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. A pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. And by the way, one little update. Nicholas Kristof, that Democrat from New York City who wanted to run for Oregon governor, this morning he got disqualified. He hasn't lived in the state long enough. He is not eligible to run. That's good news, too. And coming up, a controversy involving a Northwest school board whose board members banned politics from the classroom. That's up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving for 22 years and still going the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And I can talk to Dallas Hurd, that state senator Dallas Hurd from District 1, for probably an hour today. But there's something specific we want to talk to him about. Senator, welcome back.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Larson, for letting me come on.
You don't have to call me. Call me Lars like everybody else, if you wouldn't mind, Senator. But actually, I could ask you, let me get two quick things before we talk about Newburgh and the what I thought was the bold move of its school board members to ban politics from the classroom. First, I want to ask you about January 6th. Got anything to say about that? Because I've already said a mouthful.
I really don't have a lot to contribute to it. I think the political left obviously has an agenda to drive home. It's an unfortunate time in our nation's history for so many reasons, but I think they're trying to make it into something it definitely was not.
Okay, fair enough. Second thing is Nicholas Kristof, who wanted to run for Oregon governor, lives 3,000 miles away. But he's raised $2.5 million, and I guess the Secretary of State just cashed his ticket and said, you can't run, you're not qualified as a resident. Any thoughts on that? Because I've been arguing in favor of his disqualification since we heard he was going to run.
Well, I think the political left has a tendency, if you can't beat someone, disqualify them. But I think in this case, you're correct that it's probably the right move by Secretary Shamia Fagan. That's probably the only time you'll hear me agree with her on anything. But if he doesn't qualify by state statute, it doesn't matter regardless of political party or funds raised, an individual should not be able to run.
Well, Fagan, I guess, will get one right every once in a while. Even a blind squirrel finds an acorn now and then. Let's talk about Newburgh. And my point of view on it is the Newburgh School Board did something bold and courageous last year. They voted by a majority and said, we want all politics out of the classroom. And I agreed with that because we're seeing a lot of left-wing politics put in the classroom. But even if the classroom was populated with pro-life flags or NRA flags or whatever, I'd say, no, none of that belongs in there. Teach the kids what they need to know. And you're standing up because some of these folks are facing recall, right?
Absolutely. And I think recalls are a proper tool for the citizens to use when elected officials are not doing their job as the citizens see it as being done or should be done. But in this case, you hit the nail on the head. This is a very simple situation. It's not controversial. It's about two things. It's about political neutrality, which the public school education system that is funded by the taxpayers should never be politically biased, left or right or otherwise. So I fully agree with the school board members on that situation. And then from there, their move was about making children across the political spectrum feel welcomed in the classroom. And the teachers and the administration should be focused on educating our children, which we all know, and we're nationally known here in Oregon for being in the bottom three or four of states as far as how well we perform on educating our children. So it seems like the focus and the goals of our public education system, whether it be the teachers union or the governor or whoever, is completely out of whack. They're focused on politics, not on children being able to read and write. And let's face it, tyrants love uneducated citizens that depend on those governments.
I agree with you. Now, Senator, this is one of the things that's kind of flummoxed me, because ordinarily when somebody proposes something really completely insane, like let's let teachers put whatever agenda they want on the walls of their classroom and communicate it to their kids. In fact, I think in the next segment, there's somebody who's called in about what his daughter is hearing from a teacher about January 6th today. And we're going to talk about that then. But you would think people would say, well, of course a teacher shouldn't be able to advance his or her own political agenda in the classroom. Why isn't there a bigger hue and cry in support of the Newburgh School Board and the members who voted to do this? And why is there almost deafening silence from everybody, from the major media, from other politicians? And yet I don't hear much objection to it.
Well, sadly, elected leaders on the right are still struggling to find their courage, so they're not making enough noise as they should, and hopefully they will find that voice in the future or be replaced by men and women from the lower income or middle income classes to replace them who will do so. From the elected political left, tolerance is a one direction road. And in this case, they will only tolerate those who support their leftist agenda. And it's just really sad to see. This is not a hard issue like we've already covered. This is about educating children to be able to read, write, understand the basic aspects of world history and U.S. history, be able to properly speak and use grammar properly, unlike myself. It's not about politics. Even though my children used to go to, my oldest son used to go to a small public school in the region I live in, we then had to pull him out and send him to a small private school. I would not support my private school educators doing something similar. I would not be okay with them putting a Trump flag or a Biden flag or any kind of political-based memorabilia in the classroom, because that steers away from the actual focus of what the children are there to be educated for. It's not supposed to be about the teacher or the administration of the school's political beliefs. It's supposed to be about what we've talked about, reading, writing, and so on and so forth. And so until that is equally respected across the board, we've got a real cultural problem here. And I am challenging anyone, it doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat, not affiliated, any political affiliation, anyone in the Newburgh community or in the Yamhill County community, if you believe in freedom, if you believe in true respect that goes both ways, because that is the only kind of true respect, you must vote no on these recalls and stand strong against the Hollywood left, the Ocasio-Cortezes, and the political radicals that are trying to take over our country. The insurrection that is happening in this country is coming from the political left. They are trying to make a political party or a political movement take over our governments, and that is not what government is here to do. It's supposed to be neutral for equality and the rights of all free men and women.
I want to ask you about quality of education, because you raised the issue, Senator Hurd, but Oregon, as you point out, has been in the bottom ranks of education throughout the nation. Out of the top 50 states, we frequently rank near the bottom for school graduation, for test scores and everything else. And then we saw Kate Brown sign a bill that said you don't even have to know how to read, write, or do basic math to get a graduation certificate. And we have, if not the shortest school year in America, in the number of hours of education that are required to go to school and that are provided, we have, we're at least within the bottom five. Is there any prospect for getting that fixed?
Well, the citizens of Oregon are going to have to elect different kind of leaders than the ones we have right now. When you have a one-party system, it doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat, when you have one-party universal leadership running your state or your country, this is the kind of problems you run into. There's no competition. The teachers union individuals do not feel that they need to compete with anyone because they have a monopoly, and I think we all agree monopolies are never good, whether it's big business or, in this case, an education system. We have a monopoly going on for the taxpayers' funding. You don't have to compete with anyone. Therefore, you don't feel the pressure to produce good results. And then you become so arrogant as to think that your political beliefs should take precedent and number one priority over actually teaching those children how to read and write. And it all comes to fruition in the form of Kate Brown, who I just can't call a governor anymore. She's a dictator and other things. She does not care about and she's not invested in our children's future. She's chosen to not have her own children, her husband in life. And that's a problem for me as a parent and an Oregonian. I want to see men and women who are invested in our future and have either adopted children if they cannot produce children themselves or have decided to have children themselves. It's not to say that people don't have children aren't great people. But in this case, when you're the head person over the Board of Education and over our education system, I feel like you should actually have some proof that you're deeply invested in the next 50 years in our youth. And so her leadership, it shows what it is. And only the most politically biased individuals could turn a blind eye to this abomination that is taking place.
Well, I hope that everybody is asking candidates for governor, since there's a governor election this year in Oregon and in a couple of years in Washington, I hope they're asking all the candidates, will you change Oregon's system? Not just pile more money on a system that underperforms right now, but say either provide an adequate education and require that you meet certain competencies to be able to graduate from high school, or hand a voucher to every single parent to take their kids elsewhere. That is Senator Dallas Hurd, who represents District 1, talking about the planned recall of school board members who had the temerity to say no politics in the classroom. I'll get to some of your phone calls and emails. I'll give you the details on Nicholas Kristof's disqualification as a gubernatorial candidate, all coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and what better day for it to happen than January the 6th, at least for this month and this week. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Tobin joins me now. Tobin, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KBND. What's on your mind today?
Thanks, Lars. Well, long-time listener, and I've had the pleasure of talking with you several times before. Today, I wanted to call you and kind of pick your brain and get your feedback, but let you know what my text was from my daughter this morning at 9:53, who attends Springfield Public Schools. She's an eighth grader. We are conservative, and so I get a text from her. She says, we are talking about, and first of all, I should have joined the school board years ago, like you've always been saying, and she shouldn't be texting in class. Those are both two faults on me, and I own that, okay?
Okay.
So she shouldn't be texting in class. I receive a text message from her saying, we are talking about the January 6th thingy, and she's kind of, you know, up to current events with what's going on in the world. January 6th thingy, and it's painting Trump as the bad guy, and we're having to write about it, and it's making me uncomfortable. So immediately I texted her, you know, back and asked her whose class she was in. I asked her if, you know, she wanted to leave, she could get up and walk out and go to the office. She said that she wasn't going to do that, that she just wasn't going to do the assignment. And so, you know, I thought, okay. And then a few minutes later, she texted me, saying that only three kids participated. I'm out of the 25 or 30. I don't know how many exactly. And that she could tell that everybody was uncomfortable about it. And that, of course, the teacher painted Trump as the conspirator, which the FBI doesn't agree with. So kind of want to get your opinion and your take on this whole situation. Should I contact the principal? Should I go straight to the school board?
Let me ask you a detailed question. And that is, what kind of class? Is this a current events class?
It's language arts and social studies.
See, and this is where, Tobin, I'd fault the teacher, because there's plenty in language arts that the kids need to know, right?
Right.
And you don't have to make any of that political. If it had been a current events class, I might say, well, okay, that's the most current event that's going on today. But if it's about language arts, I mean, the kids should be learning literature, should be learning the sentence structure, you know, spelling, punctuation, you know, writing style and everything else. And you could make that completely apolitical if you chose to. The teacher is choosing to use your child, who is a captive, and her classmates, who are captive audience members for the teacher's political agenda. I absolutely think you have a beef. Now, if the principal says, but they like to write, they like to get the kids to write about current events. There are 1,000 current events they could write about today that are largely or completely apolitical, right?
Right.
And she's chosen to make it political and then to paint Donald Trump as the bad guy, which effectively communicates. Tobin, do you think I'm right in assuming that if your daughter were to write a staunch defense, not only of Donald Trump, but of the people? Now, I'm not talking about the 600 people who may or may not have committed crimes that day, Tobin. My right. stance on because we teach kids about the Boston Tea Party. You say, well, was that illegal to jump on that ship and dump the cargo into the harbor and ruin, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of dollars worth of goods? Yes, it was illegal. And I've always told people I support civil disobedience, but be prepared to take the punishment. If you want to do a sit-in at a senator's office, you may get charged with trespass. You'll get a ticket. You might have to pay a fine, stand in front of a judge. But as long as you're, you might even spend an hour or two or a night in jail, depending on what you did. But as long as you're willing to do that and understand that's the consequence, civil disobedience is completely appropriate. An awful lot of what happened on January 6th was not. Assaulting cops was not. Breaking windows, breaking doors, things like that. So I'm not defending that. But the teacher should be saying, and your daughter could write an essay, but do you think I'm right in assuming that if she wrote an essay saying the Constitution guarantees the right to assemble with like-minded people and petition the government for redress of grievances? And you'd say, well, that's in the Constitution, Lars. Of course you can do it. And in fact, I'd arm your daughter up. Mackenzie is associate producer today. We've got one person out. Mackenzie, would you play the soundbite from Donald Trump about the march to the Capitol? Play that soundbite, please. It's the Trump march to the Capitol soundbite that we pulled up from 1 year ago. I want you to hear this, if you don't mind, Tobin.
No, I don't. And you're right, it is a captive audience.
And only count the electors who have been lawfully slated. Lawfully slated. I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections, but whether or not they stand strong for our country.
Now, Tobin, did you hear him inciting to riot in that?
No, absolutely not, and he never did. I've listened to I read the transcript once a year ago, right after it happened.
Yeah, so your daughter could write a strong defense and say, I'm not going to defend any criminal acts that were committed that day. Not going to defend assaults or breaking property or anything like that, but defending the right of Americans to say, we're not happy with the election. We're not happy with the result, but we're especially not happy because laws were broken in the November 3rd election. And there's no doubt that laws were broken in at least six of the battleground states where they're required to go by the laws of their state or change the laws and do it legally. And they were changed illegally and unconstitutionally. But if your daughter writes that essay, she might just get a D. But it would be interesting to submit a legitimate essay defending what happened that day and saying to the teacher, go ahead, give it a D, and then you'll have a real complaint. I'm back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you every day of the work week. And, of course, on Conspiracy Theory Thursday, we talk about some of the crazy conspiracy theories out there and, of course, some things that are not so crazy as well. Glad to have you with me. And if you want to jump into the conversation, I'll get to calls in the next segment. It's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers go to the head of the line. And, of course, if you want to email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. If even federal agencies like the Postal Service say they cannot comply with the unconstitutional vax mandate, then why should private sector companies do it at all? And, of course, hospitals might start hiring back some of the many staff members that they fired for not taking the jab. But we've got other things to talk about today as well. I'll invite my friend of many years, former district attorney Josh Marquis, who joins me now. Josh, how are you?
Wet.
Wet.
Well, it's raining a lot here in Western Oregon.
Welcome to the Pacific Northwest. But let me ask you about this. You brought to my attention some of the comments of a state senator named Casey Jama. And you said this is not just crazy. This is dangerous stuff that Casey Jama, state senator, member of the Oregon legislature, is now proposing. Where do you want to start on this? Because I'd start with the illegal alien comments that have been made by Casey Jama, but maybe you'd start somewhere else.
Well, I mean, he has a compelling story, which some people would say is the, you know, classic American immigrant story. I mean, my own father came to the United States as an emigree from Nazi Germany in 1934, and in fact served in the United States Army while still an enemy alien. So, you know, the idea that America throws open its arms and welcomes people from places like Somalia, which was not even a nation state. It was a hellhole, and it's where he's from. So, you know, that's an interesting backstory. So what has he done with that? Well, he is already being talked about as, you know, a major contender. He is a state senator, and yet he has never run for office. And because of the engineering, which allowed him to replace the person who just decided that Nicholas Kristof can't be a candidate, Shamia Fagan, took over her spot, he won't even be up for election for 3 years. And these days, being in office for 3 years might as well be eternity. So his name is Casey Jama. He's very proud, as he should be, of his Somali background. But instead of saying, hey, I'm glad to be in America where, you know, the rights of the individual matter, he seems to be adopting something that would make him, I would think, very much at home with the warlords of Somalia. Among other things, he demands special in-state tuition for any Afghan arrivals. Now, there aren't that many Afghan arrivals, but again, creating a special terminology. He also wants to have very aggressive immigration law in Oregon statute. Now, that doesn't work. It's the same reason why states can't have foreign policies. States don't get to have foreign policies. That's the venue of the federal government.
So he wants to, and by the way, from his statement, Casey Jama, and we're going to invite Senator Jama to come on the program, but he says, we're going to stop deportations and detentions of illegal aliens. And as you point out, I mean, actually, Barack Hussein Obama fought with Arizona over this back when he was president, because Arizona said, well, we're going to arrest illegal aliens. And Obama went to court and said states are not allowed to be involved in enforcing immigration laws. They're written at the federal level. They're enforced at the federal level.
Obama was right. But just to give you I'm reading from Jama's most recent encyclical or tirade issued on January 4th on his letterhead, that the word illegal or the alien needs to be basically, it weaponizes this. He says, there is no such a thing as being an alien. Well, there is not there a is. Country in the world that does not distinguish between its nationals, its guests, and people who are seeking legally or illegally to get in. And the idea that all one need do is present oneself to the country, and that country must, particularly, as he says, if they identify as Black, Indigenous, Latinx, or other people of color. This is every nightmare that Martin Luther King fought against. You know, that not to overuse that, but to dream of a day when a person is measured not by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. When people like Senator Jama don't want them measured by anything other than the color of their skin.
And he is a person of color, right? He's a Black man.
He's Somali, which is, Somali. You know, is essentially a mix. It's a very interesting country. It's on the Horn of Africa, and it's got Arabian and African and even European influences. One of his other things, adding race and ethnicity to the Oregon income tax form. Why on earth should it matter what your race and ethnicity are in your tax form?
Well, I can tell you what the Democrats, and I know you're a Democrat, but I can tell you what Democrats would plan to do with it. They'd say people who are Black or Hispanic or Pacific Islander have been historically discriminated against. So I could envision the day when they would pass a bill, as crazy as the Oregon legislature is, and say those people should pay a lower tax rate to make up for past discrimination.
Or maybe they shouldn't pay anything, and we should pay them for them diversifying our community.
Yeah, and so he also wants to add air conditioning. He wants to mandate by state law air conditioning.
Yes, that one was, I thought was sort of entertaining. Many of them are the ones that scare the heck out of me as a longtime attorney. Establishing a restoration of voting rights for people in prison. So that means Kip Kinkle should have a right to vote.
A murderer.
Randy Guzik should have a right to vote. These are not people in prison. We allow people who are rapists, who get out of prison, we allow them in Oregon not only to vote, but to run for office. So he's taking it to the level of basically just because they committed a couple murders, they shouldn't have to give up any rights at all.
And by the way, one of the things, to go back to the alien issue, he doesn't like the term alien because he calls it insulting. Well, the problem is, right. over the years, Josh, there are lots of words, you know, that have been banned. And every time they replace, not every time, but in many cases, they take the word applied to somebody's situation and they say, well, that word is hurtful, so let's change it to something else. And then within a decade or two, they say, now that word is hurtful. In other words, every time you apply a new word, I mean, I could use the example and understand I'm using this in aid of an argument. If you say, well, you know, we used to call people imbeciles. Well, we're not going to do that anymore. So we'll call them mentally retarded. And that was the term of art for a while. And then they said, well, that's insulting. So we'll call them mentally disabled. And now disabled has a bad odor. So they say, well, we're going to change it to something else. And they keep changing the word, but it doesn't change what's behind the word, which is neither insulting or anything else. In any case, thanks for the heads up about Casey Jama, state senator, and we will invite him to be on the show. Vote in our Twitter poll, call the show, send me an email, talk@LarsLarson.com. And making kids eat outside unless it's below 38 degrees, we'll get into that as well. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. I got this email from Chris who says, Lars, could you explain on the radio how they came up with the amount of people actually killed during the riot? I keep hearing 5 officers. I don't think that's correct. There were 0 police officers who were killed in the riot. Joe Biden referenced 2 police officers, and he did a very clever job. If you actually diagrammed his sentences, you can tell how he constructively lies. He said, my wife and I have mourned the deaths of 2 police officers who died in the wake of the January 6th riot. Well, both of those officers, one was Brian Sicknick, who died of a stroke. And the medical examiner of Washington, D.C., in other words, his bosses are all liberals who run the city of Washington, D.C. The medical examiner determined that Officer Brian Sicknick died of a stroke, that it was unrelated to anything that had happened on January 6th. And then he referenced another one, Billy Evans. Police officer Billy Evans did not die on January 6th or in February or in March. He died in April. He died on the 2nd of April. He was one of the Capitol cops who was hit by a car driven by a Muslim black separatist, a Noah Green. We covered it at the time it happened. The man was angry. He was a follower of Louis Farrakhan from the Nation of Islam, and he was angry at the CIA, at the FBI, at the federal government. He had nothing to do with conservatives. He had nothing to do with Donald Trump. He rammed his car into a barricade on the 2nd of April, months after the January 6th event, and yet Joe Biden included that and said he died in the wake of, as though there was some connection. That is the kind of lie. Now, was anybody murdered on Capitol Hill? And I've had a few people push back on this. Yes, Ashley Babbitt. You murder somebody when you intentionally kill them, all right? If you accidentally kill somebody, it can be manslaughter, it can be negligent homicide, but murder takes the intentional killing of a human being. There was a police officer who shot Ashley Babbitt. She was not at that point presenting an imminent threat, which is usually the justification for any member of law enforcement to shoot somebody or to shoot and kill them. Even to shoot somebody with a gun, you have to have some justification. That police officer will not be charged. They didn't even do a full investigation. They certainly didn't consider charges against him. So Ashley Babbitt dies. She never even got mentioned by Joe Biden today. Other than that, murders or deaths of police officers because of January 6th, simply not there. Let's go to Lewis in Linden, Washington. Hey, Lewis, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Yeah, until somebody can explain to me why Ray Epps has never been arrested, interrogated, and everybody knows where he is. And until someone can explain to me why the pipe bomber, who they have photographs and video of, no place in the world probably has more of cameras and drones photographing the Capitol area than Washington, D.C. And they have tons of video of the so-called pipe bomber. Well, all I can assume is that Nancy Pelosi and the FBI don't care about the pipe bomber and were never afraid of the pipe bomber because the pipe bomber was working for Nancy.
Okay, let's bring everybody else. Can we bring everybody else up to speed about the pipe bomber? The man that Lewis is referring to is somebody. They have not been able to find him, and they don't know who he is. And they have, actually, they've invested a tremendous amount of resources. Pipe bombs were placed on January the 5th. Sometime between 7:30 and 8:30 at night, they were placed at the Republican National Committee headquarters and the Democrat National Committee headquarters. They located the pipe bombs there, and they said, okay, somebody dropped them off. The guy was wearing a hoodie. You cannot tell anything about what he looks. And they have had, here's what the FBI is listing, if you trust the FBI. The FBI has conducted 800 interviews, 23,000 video files. They've accessed 300 tips related to the investigation, and they have yet to find out who the person is. And, Lewis, if I knew who the person was. Now, Ray Epps is a different matter. You bring up the name of a man who appeared to be one of the instigators of what happened that day. A lot of us believe that Ray Epps was working for the FBI and or for some other government agency, and that he may have been one of those people paid to help, you know, provoke the riot that happened at the Capitol on January 6th. So I agree with you on Ray Epps. On the pipe bomber, what we need is somebody to report in who this guy is. He was wearing distinctive pair of tennis shoes. But other than that, you're right. There's a lot of video of him, but the video doesn't tell you who he is.
Right, and the interesting thing about that, no bomb went off. If this was a serious bomber, one of the bombs would have gone off. But yep. I don't think he was a real serious bomber. I think he's working for Nancy Pelosi. So they have an excuse to impeach Donald Trump
time. I've been saying that since a couple of days after the January 6th incident. Because there's a thing called a predicate stop that police officers do. And I think it's legit. A police officer will look at somebody and say, you know, I suspect this person might be, you know, carrying drugs, might have committed a crime, whatever. So you look for a reason, a legitimate legal reason to stop them. That's called a predicate stop. You say you made a left turn without signaling, or you have a headlight or a taillight out, and you pull the guy over or gal, and you find out they're wanted on a warrant or whatever. Some police officers seem to have a very good sense of being able to tell when somebody is their behavior draws your attention, and then you need a legal reason to stop them. In the case of Nancy Pelosi, she desperately wanted to impeach Donald Trump for a second time. And on January 5th, she didn't have any reason. They used January 6th as an excuse. And like you, I keep pointing out to people that two or three days after January 6th, the FBI held a press conference, and they announced, we knew something was going to happen on January 6th. We've been following people for days or weeks, and we warned the Capitol cops. And you know what we've determined now, Lewis? You got a warning, if a police agency got a warning, something bad is going to happen at this place on this date, the very least you would do is take special precautions. Did they staff up that day? No. In fact, their staff was diminished that day. Did they put up extra barricades? No. Did they take any special precautions that if something like what did happen started to happen, were they going to be ready for it? And the answer is no, they did not. And I think and you just have to ask yourself, who do the Capitol cops answer to? And I've been saying this since last year. They answer to Nancy Pelosi. So if your police chief gets a warning and says, hey, something bad is going to happen on this day at this place, does the police chief call whoever is his or her boss, the mayor, the city council, or in this case, Nancy Pelosi? Was she warned? I would love to see Pelosi deposed under oath and asked, did you know the Capitol Police were warned? Did you tell them to take special precautions and to staff up and bring extra gear and take extra precautions to protect the Capitol? She wanted an excuse for the impeachment. She got the excuse. And it was an illegal and unconstitutional impeachment, sad to say. But it was unconstitutional because the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who in the Constitution is designated as the person to preside over the trial in the Senate, John Roberts, said he would not take part in the impeachment trial. Now, everybody who's impeached has a right to a trial. The Senate and the House have no right to impeach a private citizen. We decided that as a country when the founders wrote the Constitution. They were used to people in England being impeached by Parliament, even though they weren't part of the government. So they said you can only impeach somebody who works for the government. And in this case, Donald Trump, by the time he was put on trial, was a private citizen. That was unconstitutional, and John Roberts confirmed it. Coming up in a moment, can illegal aliens sue the United States under the Constitution? We'll get to it next.
The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you watch what has happened over in America over the last several decades, there's been a concerted effort, and it is a partisan effort, on the part of Democrats and liberals to expand the so-called rights of illegal aliens. And at the same time, by many of us on the other side saying, no, you don't have those rights, and we need to protect our national sovereignty. If people want to come to America, we allow more than 1 million legal immigrants to this country every year. But unfortunately, the Democrats see that group of illegal aliens entering the United States as a potential group of voters that they can put to work and a dependent class that they can use for political purposes. There is a new example of this, and to talk about it, Christopher Hayek, who is director of litigation for the Immigration Reform Law Institute, joins me now to talk about a Supreme Court case that's going on. Christopher, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Lars.
Tell me about what a Bivens action is. Is there a simple way to explain that to non-lawyers like me?
Yeah, it's an action the Supreme Court invented, a kind of lawsuit that they created in 1971, where if a federal officer does something to you and you can come up with an argument that it violates the Constitution through some idea of substantive due process or something like that, then he can sue that federal officer and get damages from him personally.
Okay, and in this case, this involves a non-citizen who is trying to enter the United States, and the immigration officer who is trying to stop that person, if I understand the details of the case right, was knocked aside by the immigration officer and may have suffered some injury, and so wants to bring a Bivens action. Is that the gist of it?
Right, and before the court is the issue whether to extend Bivens, which they never extend Bivens. It was probably wrongly decided. They probably think it was, and they don't extend it much. But whether they should extend it into the immigration context. And we wrote a brief and filed it with the court arguing that that shouldn't happen. And basically the idea is, you know, the Constitution doesn't put limits on what we as a nation can do with respect to, you know, in how we deal with the rest of the world. How we act vis-a-vis the rest of the world is up to us as a nation. It's not limited in the Constitution. And immigration is an example of how we deal with the rest of the world.
Sure, because it's pointed out time and again that while we have immigration laws that allow people to enter the country, there is no constitutional right for anybody who's a foreign national to say, I want to enter your country, you have to respect my constitutional rights. You don't have any constitutional rights till you get here, right?
Right, and even if you get here and you're still under official restraint, the term is, you haven't entered the country in a legal sense, so you don't have any constitutional rights any more than you would if you were not even in the country. And that's another reason not to extend it here, because if a border officer has done something to you and you want to sue over it, that means that you've been under official restraint by that border officer. So you haven't entered the country yet, and you don't have the constitutional rights that are the basis of a Bivens action.
And so just so everybody knows, the person who is blocking the border agent is an American citizen, but he was trying to block the border agent from doing what the border agent is legally empowered to do. How bad were the injuries, just so everybody understands?
It's unclear, but they didn't seem to be that severe.
Okay, so a border
He was knocked over by the agent.
Probably got his feelings hurt more than his body. So in this case, if the court were to say, yes, you can go down and block border agents and they have no right to push you out of the way, then effectively you could say, well, if we want to get a bunch of people across the border legally, we just get a bunch of American citizens who are pro-illegal alien to go down there and get in the way of border agents, and the border agents can't do anything about it. Basically a human shield or set of human shields.
Right. There'd be all kinds of mischief that could be done. Yes.
So why is this person is saying this officer had no right to put his hands on me and push me back. That's what this comes down to. And this is going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, the issue is, again, it's sovereignty, whether we should have these kinds of actions at all in the border context. And we shouldn't, because the Constitution it doesn't have any limits there. I mean, it says that aliens only have the rights that Congress might give them in the law, and that's it. And because these aliens have not, you know, if they're illegal aliens bringing these suits, they don't have the constitutional rights that form the basis of these suits.
Is the lawsuit being brought by the American citizen who tried to block the border agent, or is it being brought by the illegal alien who's trying to get across the line?
It was brought by the American citizen. So it's but the issue comes up: if the vast majority of these cases would involve illegal aliens, and they would, and they can't sue under Bivens, they shouldn't be extending it at all. For one thing, the border agents can't even tell the difference. I mean, it's not clear at all that the agent knew that the person he pushed out of the way was an American citizen.
So tell me this, Christopher, from a legal standpoint, since you're the director of litigation at Immigration Reform Law Institute, I would assume, I think I know the law well enough, that if I showed up at a regular crime scene anywhere in America and a police officer was engaged in his or her own, you know, proper duties in dealing with that crime scene, if I get in the way of that officer, I'm guilty of a crime, aren't I?
Yes. Most likely. I mean, if you're intentionally blocking an officer, that would be an offense of one kind or another, something like obstruction of justice.
Yeah, obstruction of justice. So if the court were to say yes in this case, is this court, as it's composed right now, is it likely to say yes to the idea of opening up Bivens actions not only to American citizens who want to get in the way of immigration agents, but also illegal aliens who might say, gee, that officer grabbed me by the arm and he had no right to touch me because I have constitutional rights? Is that what they're asking the court to do as a remedy?
Something like that. And I don't think that the court will do that. That's what the Ninth Circuit did. And the district court had dismissed the case, and then the Ninth Circuit reversed.
Well, that's what they do, isn't it? That's why I called them the Ninth Circus Court, because they're the most overturned court in America.
Right. It's changing somewhat. Under Trump, they appointed a lot of new judges, and the en banc court can be good. But there are so many judges there, and there's still a great many panels who will do things like this. And, three judge panels, and the Supreme Court has to step in. I guess this is another case where, you know, hopefully that's what they're going to do.
You would think that at some point the Ninth Circus Court, I mean, even with the new members, and I watched that too, because I saw a lot of the appointments and thought, well, this is going to improve the court, but it may not change the level of crazy. Maybe it'll just reduce the level of crazy that we get from the Ninth Circus Court, but it probably won't eliminate it altogether. So we're hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, because there's so many judges. There's, you know, you can still get two on a three-judge panel that are, you know, will do something way out of line.
And then the Supreme Court, maybe the Supreme Court should have one whole section of the nine that say, you deal with the Ninth Circuit Court. Just keep knocking them back in their place because they don't seem to get the message. I would think that if I were sitting on that court, you'd say, no matter what your politics are, if you keep getting reversed by the boss, and the ultimate boss in courts is the U.S. Supreme Court, at some point, maybe you'd get the message and reform your behavior. That's Christopher Hayek, who's director of litigation for the Immigration Reform Law Institute. When we come back, I'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Go to NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And lots of folks on social media and by email, talk@LarsLarson.com, who say, Lars, you're wrong. I said, call the show as a naysayer. Well, Will had the stones to do that. Hey, Will, welcome to the program. You're a naysayer. We love the naysayers here. What do you and I disagree about today?
Once again, on the election fraud stuff, can I ask you just two quick questions?
Sure. Can I ask you a couple of questions after that?
Sure. What do you think about William Barr coming out and saying, to date, we have not seen any fraud in a scale that could have affected the outcome of the election?
It doesn't mean anything, and I'll tell you why. Because if you go to a prosecutor and say, I think so-and-so did something, and you say, we haven't seen any evidence that proves that, it doesn't mean the evidence isn't there. It doesn't mean you might see it later. It just means at this point, we don't have the evidence to show that. And by the way, Will, I'm less concerned with proving that it was done deliberately, which is what fraud would be, because you'd have to prove that you had a bunch of people who conspired together to try to change the outcome of the election. I do suspect that an awful lot of people violated the law in a lot of states and affected hundreds of thousands of votes. So the fact that William Barr said that only means he didn't have the evidence in front of him, right?
I mean, then can you at least...
Does it mean that or not?
Second question.
No, okay, go to the second question.
Well, on top of that, I guess that would... The issue with that point is that Trump, the day after the election, claimed that it was stolen. He didn't have any proof at that point, and he still doesn't.
Number one, it was stolen. Number two, he doesn't have to have the proof to say it any more than I do. He was saying, I think the election was stolen. Now, do you have do I think that somebody planted pipe bombs in Washington, D.C.? Yes. Do I think that it's been investigated? Yes. Have they found the guilty party and charged him with a crime? No. Do they have the evidence to prosecute anybody? No, not yet. I hope they do.
Lars, do you not think it's like not a great idea for the president to claim that, like just off a whim? And
no, I think it's a great idea. Will, if somebody sees a fraudulent election and they say, I think that election was fraudulent, I think it's great to call it out because that causes it to be investigated. The problem is that most of the people involved said, we don't want to investigate it. We just want this over with.
Lars, he brought forth 60 cases, and they all turned up.
Well, actually, he didn't. He brought a few of those cases. Most of them were brought by private parties, and almost all of them were decided by judges not based on the evidence in the case, but based on procedure. Do you understand the difference?
I do, and the Supreme Court also went against him. Like, what? Can you just move on, Lars?
No, I can't. Because, Will, when I know as of yesterday that Georgia is now sending out subpoenas to people because there is video evidence that is state video evidence from the state of Georgia where they have people on video cameras at 3 a.m. dropping off backpacks full of ballots into ballot collection boxes. It was only found because private parties said, we're going to go find this. They went through 2 million minutes of video and they found people who are the same people going to multiple ballot drop boxes at 3 a.m. to empty backpacks full of ballots into the boxes. Would that raise a suspicion in your mind about what was going on?
Unlike you, yes, I can say that that's suspicious. Maybe unlike you as well.
Should it be investigated?
No,
should it be investigated?
Yes, of course.
A few hours ago, the president of the United States, in the same voice in which he said, we don't believe in burying the truth, we believe in facing down the truth, but he's talking about January 6th. But when it comes to the election, what you are hearing from everybody on the left and many people, too many people on the right and everybody in the media is, nah, it's over. It's over. We're not interested in looking at that anymore.
It is over, Lars.
Well, except
you said in your own words, in the previous segment, when every court and the Supreme Court rules against you, maybe change your view. I'm pointing out.
I was talking about the Ninth Circuit Court. But Will,
In this case, no court has actually looked at the evidence. What they've done is they've said you filed the case
too early. Oh, they didn't look at the evidence?
They didn't.
Why didn't they look at the evidence, Lars?
No, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I see courts dodge issues all the time. Even the Supreme Court will dodge an issue. They'll say, we don't want to decide that one right now. And we know that's what they're doing. So when a court says,
all 60 of them.
What's that?
All 60 of them, Lars.
Yeah, but they all dodged it based on procedure. In other words,
okay,
if you went
Lars. What is more reasonable, that all these things dodged on procedure and it was just boring to them, or that Trump wanted to maintain power and these were bad cases?
It's not about Trump. It's about us, because what I care about most is not Donald Trump. I like Donald Trump. I think he was a great president. I think Joe Biden's a terrible president. What I care about is our election system, because without a legitimate election system.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
Lars,
Why would you say I don't?
All you have done, you've made a mockery out of the election system by
Now, let me ask you something. Will, in those six battleground states that really decided the election at the end of the day, laws were violated, and the Constitution, the U.S. federal Constitution, says the only way you can change those laws is go to your legislature. And what they did was they had courts change the laws. They had the governor change the law. They had the Secretary of State change the law in various states. They did it in an unconstitutional fashion. That guts our election system. I care about the election system. You want to bury this, and you want to forget about it forever, and I'm not going to. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and it's a real pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network, and always glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today, if even federal agencies say they cannot comply with the Joe Biden unconstitutional vaccine mandate, why should private sector companies do it as well? The U.S. Postal Service is now appealing to the Joe Biden administration. Remember, Postal Service is a government agency. It's an independent government agency, but a federal government agency all the same. They're saying, we can't do this. You make us impose this vax mandate, we're going to lose so many people, the mails are going to shut down. Now, in that case, I'd say if the federal government can't even follow its own dictates, I don't think the dictate should have been made to begin with, but if the federal government agencies can't do it, how in the world are private sector companies that actually have to worry about a bottom line going to be able to do it? In any case, welcome to the program. I'll get back to your calls in just a moment. Jason Mercier joins me now, who's director of the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center. Hey, Jason, welcome back to the program and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, Lars. I appreciate the break from snow shoveling or moving icicles.
Well, and hey, you wouldn't have to shovel as much snow, I guess, if the state of Washington hadn't fired so many WashDOT people over the vax mandate. But that's a subject for another time. You spend a lot of time at the Center for Government Reform watching how much money the state spends on behalf of its citizens. What are the numbers, just so you can sketch it out for people? How much is being spent on their behalf?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, especially realizing that taxes have been increased frequently over the past several years, state spending is going up and up and up. And you may think to yourself, well, you know, there's more people in Washington, there's inflation, it makes sense that spending would increase to keep up with those pressures. So what I did is I went through the Legislative Evaluation Accountability Program. That's a mouthful. That's called LEAP. That's one of the legislative budget offices for the state of Washington. And I asked them if they could go back and give me the inflation-adjusted per capita spending as far back as they have data. And they went back to 1970. And what you need to keep in mind when I give you these numbers, these are 2022 constant dollars. These numbers have all been adjusted for inflation. So back in 1970, inflation-adjusted, the state of Washington spent just under $1,800 per person. Fast forward to the supplemental budget that the governor just proposed, the one that the legislature is going to be holding public hearings on, that would increase to just under $5,000 per person. We're talking about almost 179% increase per person, inflation adjusted in spending since 1970.
Now, that's an all funds number. In other words, because I know that state governments, like criminal organizations, run two sets of books. They talk about the general fund budget and the all funds budget, right?
That is actually just the state funds. When you include the all funds, it's even higher. And this would make sense when you consider how much federal funding Washington has gotten the last couple of years because of the COVID package. But if you look at all funds, state, federal, everything that the state of Washington is spending, those same numbers back in 1970 were just under $2,500 per person. And in the governor's supplemental budget, that would jump to $8,200 per person.
So it's more than tripled in the 50 years.
And again, with the federal, the reason I focus on the state dollars is the federal gets a little bit sideways when you talk about some of the relief packages and things that will come for emergency spending. But just on the state funds, just the one that's correlated to our taxes, we have to ask ourselves, are we getting that much more service than we used to? And, you know, let's not go back to 1970. Let's just go back to when the governor was elected back in 2012. And in 2012, that per person inflation adjusted spending was just under $3,200. And again, jumping up to just under $5,000 here, just what is it now, 9 years into his term.
So it has almost doubled, not quite doubled, over 10 years.
And when you think about where that money is going, they're going to say, well, we have a lot of needs, right? You've got needs in education, you've got needs in social service, and that's very true. But where I wanted to draw attention, and the reason why we put these numbers out before session started, is we are sitting on roughly $8 billion more in revenue over a four-year period than what the legislature assumed when it adopted the budget just a few months ago back last year. So I guess the proposition I would have with the legislature, rather than continuing to increase that spending even more, maybe, just maybe, it's time to provide a little bit back to Washingtonians in the form of a tax cut.
I love that idea, because when I see government that says, well, our budget is going to increase, and it almost always increases faster than inflation and faster than people's paychecks. If you ask the average person, we've had inflation until Joe Biden arrived. Inflation clocked in America at about 2 points, right? Am I about there, 1.9 or 2.0?
Yeah, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers. I just know that we're on, I think, a 40-year high in inflation over the past year.
You're right, over the past year. But until Biden arrived, until energy costs went crazy and everything else, inflation went up about 2% a year. So if your paycheck went up 2% or a little bit more, you could actually gain some ground in terms of real spending power. But if you have a government that's seen inflation go up, you know, triple over, say, the 50 years, so you go up that much, you've got government growing at a much faster rate than the people's paychecks are, right?
And that's why you keep seeing the tax increase proposals come to us. Now, the governor, which is understandable if you consider the fact that we've got $8 billion more to spend, did not have any tax proposals in his most recent budget. But some of the voices that the legislature listens to that pushed through the capital gains income tax last year has already released their wish list for this next session starting on Monday. And on their wish list is a wealth tax, taxing the payrolls of businesses, and other type of tax increases. When you consider the fact of how much the state budget is increasing and how much money in surplus is already available, the fact that any tax conversation is even being put forward is pretty shocking. But it really is time to raise our expectations. It is time for tax cuts. You know, in Oregon, you guys got them because you have that automatic kicker with your income tax returns. Washington is one of just a couple of states in the past 2 years that hasn't cut taxes. And if we can't do it with this much additional money coming in, I don't know if the state of Washington ever will.
And by the way, Jason, I know that Oregon, I mean, I live in Washington State, so I pay Washington taxes, but because I work across the boundary, I pay taxes in both states. That's my choice. But they had a $1 billion sales tax called the corporate activity tax that's being charged. $1 billion in sales taxes on a state that notoriously hates sales taxes as much as Washington State hates income taxes. And they're rolling in dough right now, and they can't wait to spend it. And they don't want to send it back. And I think the only reason they haven't taken the kicker away is because it's in the Constitution, and they can't get away with changing the Constitution right now. Jason, thanks for the time. That's Jason Mercier, director of the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center. When I come back, I know a lot of you want to comment, and I want to talk about a big hearing that's coming up tomorrow. The State Board of Health is going to consider giving police powers to lock people up when it comes to communicable diseases. That sound familiar? We'll talk about that up next.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And this segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. And our Twitter poll today, you can find it two places. I'm not that crazy about Twitter anymore. Haven't been for a long time. But on Twitter, it's at Lars Larson Show. And on our website, it's LarsLarson.com. If even federal agencies have confessed that they cannot comply with Joe Biden's unconstitutional vaccine mandate, why should private sector companies do it at all? The U.S. Postal Service is now appealing to its bosses in Congress and in the White House, saying, we can't do this. You make us fire all these people who won't take the jab, and we're not going to deliver the mail. We can't get it done. Now, if that's the case, can you imagine what it's doing, not to an agency like the Postal Service that loses $10 billion a year, but private sector companies that actually have to make a bottom line? In any case, glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go first to Stephen. Hey, Stephen, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I just want your viewers to know that I'm a computer programmer, and I can write code in 30 seconds that will reverse values. You're talking about electronics with, you know, binary code, and you can switch like a negative to a positive number. So that makes it very easy to switch a voting machine to say you're voting for one person to make it appear like you're voting for a separate.
I agree. Although I don't think that's how the 2020 election was stolen, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and I agree with you. There's so many different factors involved, but what my concern is that it trusts but verifies. So if those computers are truly accurate, then why will they not let you inspect them? What about the custody of or chain of custody where?
Yep.
There's definite spots where there was nobody there to protect them from being, you know, messed with. So that's just my concern.
No, and Stephen, to add to your concern, if people said, well, how would that program get in there? We were told with great assurance that the voting machines were not connected to the Internet. And then we came to find out after the election, well, as a matter of fact, they were connected to the Internet. Now, can you imagine? Wouldn't you want to air gap any computer that was being used to count votes so that, you know, in the same ways that the top secret scientific labs will air gap a computer? That is, it's not connected to the outside. Because once it's connected to the outside for the convenience of those people inside the institution, it also means that people from outside the institution can get in. And we hear about computer breaches all the time these days, you know, where big companies and government agencies that have taken lots of precautions still say, yeah, somebody managed to get into our system. Well, you wouldn't have that problem if you kept them not connected to the Internet. But the Internet's very, very, you know, very handy when it comes to getting things done. So I understand what you're saying, and you're right. Programs like that. But see, I think they went with a more pedestrian method. First of all, they violated the laws of the state. So there were states that said, we won't send you an absentee ballot unless a voter requests it. And yet there were a lot of those states where the government said, because of COVID, they use COVID as an excuse, we're just going to send absentee ballots to a whole bunch of people who never asked for them. And you say, well, are you allowed to do that? Not under state law, but our elections director or the secretary of state or a judge ordered that we do it. Well, the U.S. Constitution says you can't change the law that way. In any case, I appreciate the call. Let's go to David. Hey, David, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Pleasure and an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
This is great. And I, in fact, one of those fired DOT workers, so I'm home today. I can give you a call. So
you should be out plowing snow. Oh, well, maybe that's not your gig, but, I mean, did they fire a whole bunch of people at WashDOT who should be out doing those jobs right now?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yep, no doubt. Anyway, the reason for my call, I don't know, maybe you or maybe one of your listeners can shed some light on this, and I think you touched on it just before you went to commercial break. I got a message from a friend today regarding a meeting or a Zoom discussion that's going to take place on January 12th with the Washington State Board of Health.
I have it right in front of me. David, you know what? Great minds think alike. I put that on at 2:20. As the time I had planned to talk about that,
I believe, you know, what's happening is the State Board of Health, the SBOH, is going to have a public hearing tomorrow from 9:30 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon. And what it allows, tomorrow. It allows local health officials to use law enforcement to force an emergency order to involuntarily detain a person or a group of persons to be isolated in a quarantine facility. And I've got the WAC numbers as well, the Washington Administrative Code. What do you think of that?
So now you're showing that as taking place tomorrow. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's the 12th. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. You're right. It's a week from now. So it should happen
a next week.
From
so it is
next week. So it's January 12th. And go ahead.
Okay, so that is going on. Okay, that's
Well,
okay.
And I'll tell you what, David, I got a slew of emails over the earlier part of this week, and what I always do is I try to check things out. Unfortunately, the internet is full of fakes. So I went to the State Board of Health website itself, the one that is the state's website, and then having looked at the agenda. I sent a note off to the young lady who's identified as the communications person for that agency, and I said I'd like to get somebody on from your agency. You're allegedly having a public hearing. I'd like come on my show. I get out to the whole region. I mean, we've got Oregon, Washington, Idaho. We can communicate this to the whole region and tell people what you're up to, and I would love to have them do that. Have I heard back from that state agency yet? No, and I'm not holding my breath either.
You won't.
Well,
you won't.
Doesn't it strike you as strange, David? If you worked, I've never had a state job in my life. I've never had any kind of government job. But if you were the communications person for a big state bureaucracy, and you said, we want the public's input on this rule, and we want this authority to use law enforcement to lock people up, and if you have to use law enforcement, it means you're locking them up against their will, right? Which is a scary idea. And
absolutely.
So if you truly wanted to hear what the public had to say about that, wouldn't you take an invitation like mine? We've got an average audience of about 1 million in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on a daily basis. So wouldn't you want to take that invitation, come on and say, hey, folks, this is what we're planning to do. Someday, we don't know why we want the authority, but we want the authority that we can go out and lock up a person or even a group of people in quarantine over their objections. What do you think of that? And what do you think most Washingtonians would make of that?
Well, first of all, you're going at it from the wrong angle. I mean, you're it's Washington State. It's, you're using logic, and that's not fair.
Well, can you imagine? I mean, you say, well, if we tell people about this, they're going to be upset. They're going to be upset. Well, and David, one time, I'll share something inside baseball. We're going to head up to the break here in a second. One time, I've worked under contracts for about the last 30 years of my professional career. And one day, I said, I was working on a new contract with my employers decades ago. And I took it to my lawyer to look it over. And he said, have them take this out. And I said, why? He says, this says that if the transmitter tower blows over, they don't have to pay you for 8 weeks and you can't go get a job elsewhere. I said, yeah, but they said they're never going to use that. He said, if they're never going to use it, take it out. They don't need the authority. If they leave it in there, then they can always use it. And people should approach the law the same way. If they've got the authority to use it, someday they're going to do it. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a bit at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And, of course, if you want to use email, just send me an email, talk@LarsLarson.com. Almost every day for the last couple of weeks, I've seen teachers' unions that say, we don't want to teach. We want to stay home. We want the kids to go into distance learning. Variations of this going on all over America. And I think Americans are sick to death of it, parents especially. And not just because when their kids are in school, they don't have to provide childcare and things like that. But Americans have paid for that public education. And when those who supply it in most cases, most of them in public schools run by government agencies, most of them members of labor unions, a lot of us get pretty hot under the collar saying, hey, hold on, you're not going to do the job that you're already getting paid to do? Then let us take our kids elsewhere. Aaron Witt is the Freedom Foundation's national director, and he joins me now. Aaron, welcome back to the program, and Happy New Year, since it's the first time I've talked to you since the 1st of January.
Lars, Happy New Year to you. Thank you for having me on.
So what's going on here? The teachers' unions, where the, you know, routinely, I've covered I don't know how many teachers' strikes over the years or threats of strikes. They always say it's all about the kids. And when it comes to passing bond measures or raising taxes, they say it's all about the kids. It appears that the all about the kids line is out the window these days.
Yeah, exactly, Lars. Yeah, you're exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. The teachers' unions are completely overplaying their hand here. They see themselves as a political party nowadays, and even Mayor Lori Lightfoot of Chicago is turning around and encouraging teachers to be teaching in school because that's what they're there to do. And that's what I think most teachers across the country want to do, except with the exception of these major liberal cities like Chicago, like Portland, like Seattle.
So what are they asking from the, you know, from the parents and the taxpayers and the government? Are they saying just keep paying us our paychecks and keep putting money in our pensions, but we're not going to actually deliver the goods for your kids?
Yeah, essentially that's what they're saying. But that doesn't represent the value of most teachers, I don't think. Most teachers across the country, but people like my wife who's a public school teacher, they want to be in school teaching. They want to go teach kids math, English. They don't want to be sat at home not doing their jobs, feeling guilty about making the money that the government is basically forcing them to take. They want to be out there doing this. They don't want to be teaching critical race theory or making their kids wear masks. Or in Oregon, you know all too well how they've dropped the graduation standards. They want to teach quality education, and the teachers' unions are going completely against that.
I mean, here's the thing I don't understand, Aaron. I've worked in the news business most of my life. And when I was a reporter, we kept our opinions out of stories. If we saw one of our colleagues saying, I'm going to sneak some opinion into my stories, usually that meant you ran down the hall to the news director and said, hey, you can't allow this kind of thing. In other words, we believed in the professional standards. And I think most of the people listening to this who work in a profession, whether you're driving a truck, if you see a truck driver, one of your fellow coworkers, who's doing the job incorrectly or dangerously or just incompetently, you call it out. And that's where I have respect for teachers. I know there are people who say, well, you don't like I love teachers, but I want them to do their jobs. And when they tell me I'm a proud member of a union, I say, well, then use your union. It's an incredible political force in America. It's usually one of the most powerful unions in any city, any state, and in the country nationally. Use your union to demand that your fellow teachers actually do the job, do it well, and do it apolitically. And yet, I don't hear a lot of that hue and cry coming from the individual union members who are part of a group that collectively bargains. And I always remind them, I said, you can change what the union does. And most of them, highly educated professionals, say, oh, no, we have to do whatever the union tells us to do. I say, you are the union. Can't you go in and say, we're not doing this way anymore?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the major problems, though, Lars, is that teachers and other government employees that choose to opt out of their unions have their ability to talk to the union completely taken away from them, which is completely wrong. The teachers' unions, as you reference, are some of the biggest political players in the whole country nowadays. But they've gotten to this point because they've had a monopoly on being able to take union dues from teachers and other public employees. Now what's starting to happen is that public employees and teachers are learning that they can leave their unions and opt out. And when they're doing that, the union's voting members are becoming more and more to the left because the people that that want to be teaching in schools, they've already left their unions, and therefore they're not voting in union elections, which is an issue that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, it does. In fact, I actually agree with, you know, one of the big heroes of the Democrat Party is FDR. FDR did not think that government employees should be allowed to be unionized at all. And I tend to agree with them because I think it's a very incestuous relationship. I mean, if I went to my boss, Aaron, and I said, hey, boss, you give me a $10,000 raise and I'll kick back $3,000 into your pocket, that's illegal. But if a union goes to their bosses, the school board or the state legislature, and says, hey, give our members a big boost in their paychecks and we'll make sure that your campaign coffers are full, that's completely legitimate for no good reason. I mean, because nowhere else in America are you allowed to bribe people except in politics. And when politics and education intersect, the kids end up on the short end of the stick.
Yeah, you're exactly right. They're using kids as political pawns in their game here. In no other industry is this allowed, but in the government sector, this is just the way that they do business, and it's completely wrong. But I do believe that the tides are turning. Now that government employees are allowed to leave their unions and the Freedom Foundation is running this campaign to tell every single one of them to leave, when they learn that they can opt out, put $1,100 a year back in their pockets, they opt out in droves. So I think the tides are turning. The union's best days are gone. I think they're overplaying their hand completely, and it's going to slap them in the face in 2022.
I'm talking to Aaron Wythe, who's the Freedom Foundation's national director. You know, the other sales point I wish you'd make to union members, because it's one thing to say you get $1,100 back. That's nice. But for an awful lot of teachers, the ones who complain to me, they say, look, I don't like that my union supports, say, pro-abortion causes, because I'm not pro-abortion, and yet, they're doing this on my behalf. Or, you know, and all the other things that the unions oppose, like school vouchers and things like that. You know, the idea that you're forced to be a member or contributing to, you know, things that you don't believe in at all should be anathema to Americans. They should say, you shouldn't be forced to support a political point of view that you don't believe in.
Yeah, no, exactly right. They shouldn't be, but they have been up until this point. We've used all the stances that teachers' unions have taken over the past couple of years. And in 2021, we helped more teachers to opt out of their unions than ever before because of their radical stances, like keeping kids out of schools, critical race theory, and you go through the list. All of this has led to more teachers leaving the unions than ever before, and we at the Freedom Foundation will continue to use those issues as long as the unions take those stances.
Well, I know they're showing big losses, and I think they're starting to get desperate, and they should be especially desperate, because imagine this. If you're a part of a union this year, the politicians on the left who get 99% of all the contributions from unions are still going to expect big checks from the unions. And yet, if you take a look at the landscape right now, do you think the Democrat Party and its candidates, both nationally and locally, are going anywhere good in 2022?
No, I think that Democrats in swing districts are actually going to stray away from taking money and being helped by the teachers' unions, because we saw what happened in Virginia. It was absolutely no help. In fact, it was a hindrance. I think in swing states, that's going to be the stance of candidates. And in Oregon and Washington and these hard liberal states, then that's probably not true. They probably will still continue to support, and those candidates will still take that money. But they're overplaying their hand, and it's going to slap them back in the face come election.
Well, they deserve that slap in the face. Aaron, thanks so much. That's Aaron with the Freedom Foundation. We'll be back in just a moment. Your phone calls and emails are welcome on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. A couple of things I want to mention. Nicholas Kristof, who we have talked about on this program for a while, he wanted to run for governor of Oregon. He is not a resident of the state and has not been one for the 3 years required by the state constitution. Today, at least the Democrats get one right every once in a while. The Secretary of State of Oregon ruled that Nicholas Kristof is not qualified, does not meet the requirements, and so that $2.5 million in contributions that he managed to cobble together to run for an office he's not qualified for, I don't know what he's going to do with the money, whether he has to turn it back or not, but he won't be running for governor. There is a chance he will contest that decision by the Secretary of State. I don't think he's going to be able to successfully contest it. They have to print the ballots, I think, by March the 17th, and there is not probably time to get a judge to reverse it. And besides that, the state constitution in the state of Oregon is very clear. You have to have residency in the state for 3 years to be able to run for the position of governor. And Nicholas Kristof voted in the November 3rd, 2020 election, which means he swore under penalty of perjury that he was a resident of New York as recently as November of 2020, and yet he wants to run for a position in which you have to have been a resident of the state of Oregon for the past 3 years. He does not qualify. And by the way, we'll invite Nick Kristof to come on the program if he wants to say something publicly. I have a feeling his run for governor is now dead. And by the way, Tina Kotek, who had been House Speaker, she is now stepping down from the legislature to focus entirely on her run for governor. If you thought Kate Brown was bad, Tina Kotek promises to be worse. So you're going to have to keep an eye on hers, and we will do that as well. Let's go to Brian. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you with me. What's on your mind?
first off, I want to say thanks for giving me a heads up on the runner-up. Mainly on my mind was that caller about Trump. I want to say it's not just about us, but those who have kids. It's about our kids as well and what they're going to be growing up to. And we want to make sure that they have a safe and fair election every single year. And if somebody yep. like our president feels like they were this, the election was stolen from them, it is legal for them to say that it was stolen.
Yep.
What's not legal is our justice system not taking the time to thoroughly go through it to make sure that it was or was not stolen.
I agree. And Brian, I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions in this country I'd love to get answers to. Benghazi and why we ended up with a murdered ambassador. I mean, and they seem to pile up. And once we get a little ways past them, there are folks both on the right and the left who say, oh, that's over. That's past history. No, I don't think so. And what really seems strange to me was Joe Biden today. I know he just, for the most part, reads off a teleprompter. But he said, it is not right to bury the past. You have to face up to the truth. Well, he was talking about January 6th, which is now a year ago. But isn't it just as important to take a look back at an election that many of us still have serious questions about? And when I have people say, well, that's all over. It's all been decided. Well, there are lots of things that have been decided. It was decided that Oswald shot Kennedy. Okay. Do you think all the questions have been answered? I'd say that all these decades later, all the questions have not been answered. And when it comes to elections, if you say just accept that there will be some cheating in elections, that laws will be violated, that ballots will be harvested, that billionaires like Zuckerberg will be able to pour money into efforts that subvert our elections, no. I don't think saying, well, that's over. It's November 3rd, 2020. Let's just move on. That's not good enough. As you point out, this isn't about Donald Trump. It's about whether or not Americans can trust their elections. And at this point, I would say we cannot. Let's go to Joe. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hello, Lars. Thanks for having me. I'm sorry I'm on speaker on my car.
No worries. You're Bluetooth.
I went to the November rally in D.C. Absolutely 100% peaceful. The only violence was the caged-in Antifa with the media behind them looking at the Trump guys, yelling and screaming at them. But that was the vantage point, of course, the media wanted you to see. But then also, isn't it very minimally for the America to contest election results by showing some upset behavior? I'm not saying January 6th was all what it was. I think it was manipulated by the FBI and
I agree.
The various other government
It was
government
manipulated,
agents.
But we should be upset, shouldn't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To me, it's a coup of our nation. It's an absolute coup of our nation. Trump landslid this nation, and Joe Biden wants to bury history. Let's start looking at the history of Antifa, the background checks on all these idiots that were paid protesters running around the country, tearing up legitimate businesses and destroying. And in some cases, some people say in Chicago, they were targeting businesses that did not pay ransom and extortion payments. And they would allow them because some businesses were attacked on the same street, other businesses were not. So this is all, if you want to really look at history, let's look at the paid protest of the Antifa clowns that ran around, destroyed our nation.
Well, and Joe, you know what I'd add to that? Conspiracies, even though it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, are hard to prove. But do a lot of us believe that that was coordinated activities among cities and that people were being flown around the country? We know people who've been on airplanes with some of the people who are flying into a city to stage a protest and be the agitators and then flying on to another city to do that. If the FBI can track down everything there is to know about the 727 people who were arrested in connection with January 6th, they certainly ought to be able to track down the folks who were coordinating a year's worth of riots in major American cities. Joe, thanks for the call. You've got the Radio Northwest Network.